The Brief is supported by Bloomberg Connects, the free arts and culture app. Labour restores housing targets and resurrects onshore wind. Matthew Pennycook named housing minister as Levelling Up is ditched. Chris Williamson wins RIBA's presidential election, and the search is launched for a design team to create a Grenfell Tower memorial. My name is Merlin Fulcher. I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's big stories in architecture, planning, and housing news. Welcome to The Brief from Open City. My guest this week here at Bureau in Design District is Akhil Scaife-Smith. Akhil is an urban designer and co-founder of Resolve, an interdisciplinary design collective that combines architecture, engineering, technology and art to address social challenges. Akhil, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Good to be here, Melon.
After Labour's landslide victory last week, Prime Minister Keir Starmer has promised national renewal and said that change begins now. And the party is kicking off its first full week in power with a host of headline-grabbing announcements. In her first speech as Chancellor on Monday, Rachel Reeves announced major changes to UK house building and green energy policies. These include bringing back compulsory house building targets and lifting the de facto ban on onshore wind farms. Reeves said that bringing back mandatory housing targets for local authorities, which were scrapped by the Conservatives back in 2019, would help Labour fulfil its manifesto pledge to build 1.5 million new homes over the next 5 years. The Chancellor also laid out Labour's plans to reform the National Planning Policy Framework to help deliver infrastructure and housing. These include plans to loosen restrictions on greenbelt building and to reverse what Reeves describes as England's absurd ban on onshore wind, saying that decisions should be taken nationally, not locally. Okay, so Akhil, it's been a jam-packed week and there's lots to unpack. Let's start with bringing back mandatory housing targets. Why is this announcement grabbing so many headlines?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why this has become particularly attractive is also because of the kind of tanking of the previous target that was set by the Tories this year that wasn't being met. So 2,034,000 homes instead were being built, and that became a huge hullabaloo in the media, right? So there was a lot of attention around the failure to meet those targets. I think that's probably part of it. I think that in inner planning circles, there's going to be a little bit of ambivalence around whether or not this is a helpful bind for a lot of boroughs, particularly boroughs like Croydon and Lambeth, and also city councils like Birmingham, who are feeling kind of constrained as it is and are kind of flirting with or having gone through these waves of administration, decreasing their capacity. There is this question as to whether or not something that binds them, a numerical bind, is of any help. For me, there's a big question around numbers. Like, what is the utility of numbers and of binding local authorities to these numbers as well? There's a kind of status quo-ishness to it all.
I mean, it's certainly interesting that, like, we've lived in a time without housing targets. Like, imagine any, like, of us or listeners, like, we've all had jobs and we've been given, like, targets. Like, oh, can you do this, please? And you're like, yeah, I'll try my best. And, like, imagine this boss, he's like, you know what? If the money comes in, that's good. Or if you feel it's right to make some money today, like, that's cool. Do you see what I mean? It's, like, pretty interesting that we've lived through a time of no targets.
Yeah, definitely. But I would also add that those targets have actually been in some detriment to like a wider strategy. Those are an important part, I think, of like meeting these steps. And I think like to have completely gotten rid of them was a mistake. But at the same time, they're the draconianness to like this idea of having to have this number by the end of the year. Yeah. And when you get, and if you don't, you get penalised by that. There can be some difficulty in that too.
Yeah, and certainly there's a history of targets sort of being misinterpreted or having unintended consequences. Like even in Britain's post-war housing boom, like, yeah, a lot of houses were built, but some of them were built in really cynical ways and they had to be taken down again. Do you know what I mean?
So, and to add as well, like even in the, you know, so during our housing booms, and also there was the housing boom in the 70s when 250,000 homes were being built, but at the same time,
it was 300,000 plus.
300,000 plus, exactly. But 200,000 were being demolished. Mm-hmm. And so the slum clearance programs were still going on. And this is the thing about a game of numbers. With my most pessimistic hat on, what I'm seeing is an over-determination of those numbers, a willingness to engage in a game of numbers by which you have the highest numbers and therefore you win, rather than kind of questioning what it means to be engaged in this kind of game and how do we restructure ourselves out of that.
One of the most fascinating things is the kind of media coverage of this. People are chatting about planning reform on like the national news, you know, like Twitter's full of everything. Everyone's sounding off about it in a way that, you know, a few months ago, no one, you know, only the most niche corners of commentary were interested in this. Now, some people have like turned to sort of planner bashing. There's been a real pushback on that because it's not the case. Like RTPI had to sort of issue a statement after some columnists were saying like planners are evil and stuff. This isn't about attacking planners. But it's interesting in some of the other corners of the response, we've seen that the UK's largest property and house building firms, they've welcomed this reintroduction of housing targets. I think this was covered by the FT yesterday, and they're calling them particularly encouraging, right? So what does it mean when your house builders, because you know, they've been around for a while, okay? They've been active in this market for a while. What can we read into the endorsement from them? And do you share their kind of optimism around this?
Yeah. In terms of whether I share that encouragement, no, not necessarily, but I think that's a wider part of me not being so optimistic about, or at least not so enthused about the current Labour government, but we'll get onto that. In terms of what that means and how to read that, for me, like I mentioned, that kind of status quo-ishness again, and that's how I personally read that. There is a way in which there's a productive dissensus around whether or not we build towards the maintenance of like profit margins and how we kind of financialize land and buildings in the city, or do we take these kind of radical steps within which the house builders and the property companies aren't going to be encouraged initially. And that's also not me with a kind of saying these things with a naive, you know, let's destroy them and just move on. That's why I use that kind of word dissensus. I think there needs to be this generative moment of dissensus by which their interests aren't at the top.
Yeah, and it's certainly, you know, fascinating to see that, for example, the share prices went up of all the house building companies on Monday after the outcome of the election. You know, these are the same house building companies who've been sort of dominating this industry, which has been underperforming, you know, for decades. Yeah. Now, it's been sort of widely put across, certainly on social media, that really the best way to actually deliver the sort of mix of housing we need is for there to be a large amount of state-directed funding, like social house building program. It was put to Rachel Reeves' press conference yesterday, would there be that happening? And she replied quite directly, this is about enabling the private sector. So what's going to be the outcome of that, you know, for your average person looking for a home? And then also, you know, I think you probably have some experience of this. You worked for Croydon Council as an in-house architect designer. What does it look like when people try and build that sort of state directed housing?
Yeah, I think that's a super interesting question. I mean, like in terms of what this kind of shift towards state directed building, I think that there's two layers to it, really. One of which is the state directed implementation of housing and a model that doesn't look so dissimilar from kind of 20th century models. And that is what, when Croydon were doing a lot of house building, they were engaged in. So we had an in-house architecture team. There's other teams that had in-house design qualities and expertise, and they were delivering those models in that way. Now we've come to the kind of tail end of some of those models now, and a lot of those in-house developer organizations within local authorities no longer exist. A lot of that, in my personal opinion, isn't because of the ineptitude of those individuals, but rather because of the kind of structure in which the local authorities are being forced to perform. But we have to, within that type of model now, be seriously looking at like retrofit as a means of delivering these homes and the kind of readaptation of existing assets, private or otherwise. That's the key question.
Okay, and so some people would say, you know, there's obviously economic reasons why we can't do this. That's what Rachel Reeves is saying. Is there an economic miracle that we could go through? You're just saying, just be brave. Is that...
I'm honestly just saying, be brave. The monetary argument that Labour have also been contributing to, but one that has been largely invented by the Tories, is one that's just about our current financial restrictions put in place by the machinations of government. But really, the boldness of how governments act, it feels to us as if it's God sent. I think the near history really dictates to us that these are things that they are possible to achieve.
Okay, so lifting the ban on onshore wind farms, it's delighted environmentalists and energy experts. Just how significant is this for delivering on the UK's climate goals? Are we going to see some windmills popping up in central London soon?
Maybe in South London.
Up on the hills.
Up on the hills, yeah. You know, this has actually been one of the easy wins of a government change, which do make me optimistic. In some ways, it's a kind of like a categorical changing of like the space debris that orbits the political solar systems when we change a government. there will be other easy wins. And I think there have been some already. And those are ones in which social justice organisations like ourselves, kind of campaigners, activists, can start to jump on and really exploit the cracks in the system in that way.
What do you make of Labour's plans to build on sort of poor quality areas in the Green Belt? This is what they're describing as the so-called grey belt, things like disused car parks, petrol stations, etc. Yeah. Why is this a point of contention? Like, it's a disused car park, do you know what I mean? And what do you think of this as a solution to get things moving?
Yeah, yeah. I think that, to me, this is another one of the easy wins. I actually think that this is an easy win that has been taken too easy. In some ways, I'm really attracted to Russell Curtis's work on the Gulf Belt. You know, he's got a lot of his work around the Green Belt and all the golf courses that exist in the Gulf Belt. He has these crazy stats, which is like 94 active golf courses on the Green Belt around London. 21 of London's boroughs have at least one course. Some have seven, like Enfield. So a lot of the Green Belt is really taken up by these formats for leisure, but the leisure of the few. And that's not also to misinterpret who is playing golf. But for me, that's taking it one step further.
Yeah, it's really interesting because obviously you can imagine in the Green Belt, you know, people who live there, they probably love it and they think, you know, keep it the same, fair enough. Like, a lot of people have those views. And they might look at this sort of depressed petrol station and be like, no, I love the charm of the depressed, abandoned petrol station. Do you know what I mean? But it's like someone's got to like sell them the imagination, like sell them the dream. Yeah. Like, it can be better to live here. The response from architects to a Labour landslide has been mixed. So Miyiwa Okies, the president of the RIBA, has said, this is a monumental moment for the UK. The manifesto doesn't have all the answers, but it shows ambition. So that's what Miyiwa was saying. Meanwhile, Charles Holland of Charles Holland Architects, he said, on housing, nothing Labour has said has convinced me that they understand what is needed is a fundamental rethink of how we deliver new homes and build new communities, and that the state and the local authority have a central role to play in this. So Charles ain't so impressed. Where do you sit, okay, on that scale? Miyiwa, Charles, where are you?
I'm behind Charles. I want to be very honest here, but I also want to try and be clear and pragmatic, because like I said, with these easy wins, and actually engaging within a current political system requires an acknowledgement of what the restraints are behind why those people are doing what they're doing, and also just the cards that we've been dealt. But I've got a personal like disavowalment of party politics, and that's been for the last number of years. I think that a lot of the work that I do and that we do at Resolve is around what Annette from Dark Matter Labs calls like the deep code of like socio-political structure. And so actually we're thinking, when we're working with community, when we're working in these kind of ways, we're thinking about how we fight structural issues around topics of liberation, around topics of radical movements, around topics of decolonization, abolition, etc. And there's a mismatch there in just kind of jumping on any bandwagon that comes into the House of Parliament. But all of that is really to say that it's not without some positive. There's a positive in the weakening of the Tories as an institution. You know, like, that is a huge positive.
Next up, in the new government's first big week of action, Labour has, quote, firmly tip-exed out the words levelling up from the government department responsible for housing and communities. So the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities was given the name by Boris Johnson back in 2021 as the then Prime Minister sought to highlight his commitment to reducing geographical inequalities. But with a change of government comes yet another change of name. Angela Rayner will instead become the Secretary of State of the Department for Housing, Communities and Local Government. She tweeted, quote, no more gimmicks and slogans, but the hard yards of governing in the national interest. Reporting to Rayner is Matthew Pennycook, who has been appointed as the Housing Department Minister. Pennycook, MP for Greenwich and Woolwich, has served as Housing Minister since 2021 and was considered the logical choice for the position. Pennycook is the nation's first Labour Housing Minister in 14 years. It is a role that has seen a rapid turnover. There were 15 Housing Ministers between 2010 and 2024. Okay, Akhil, what do you think Labour's doing in dropping the levelling up moniker?
I think there's a really crude answer in that, like, the levelling up moniker, the name, that was Bojo's flex, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so therein lies a kind of immediate way in which you get rid of that. Like, this is associated to Bojo in a really, really kind of pertinent way. Like, everyone does that in maybe thinking about that when we think of this idea of levelling up. And so to scrap that, I think, is a must. In many ways, for a change of administration. I think that there's interesting discussion around like the vitality of slogans and slogan using. You know, like, anyone who has any experience in central or local government will know that like sentences are constructed using largely 90% slogans and acronyms.
Right.
And actually, if we're disavowing this idea of slogan use, if that is a serious statement and not a kind of flippant one by Angela Rayner, then we might be going into a kind of interesting territory.
Yeah, it certainly it seemed like Boris Johnson was like that kind of man of the slogans. Yeah, leveling up is a bit like you're playing a computer game and you're like collecting all the coins and then you become like a different Pokemon.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, Starmer and Rayner have made reforming the planning system and building more houses a key ambition of the new government. Now, this marks their housing minister appointment. It's quite a vital appointment, I guess, in that, you know, central plank of their government. What can we expect from this 16th housing minister, Matthew Pennycook? Are you optimistic, given there has been a lot of churn in the past? Do you think, you know, is Pennycook a stayer? Is he going to be around?
You know, I've got to say, like, I'm apathetic about Pennycook, and I don't know whether he'll be good or bad. I've got a kind of limited understanding of his role as the MP in Greenwich. I think for me, the wider question around the churn is probably indicative not just of the Tory mismanagement of that role, and I say that with a heavy heart because I wish I could blame the Tories for everything. I think that actually, in many ways, it's indicative of a kind of disjuncture between the apparatus of government, the tools that we have of government, this idea of the role of the housing minister, and this kind of really fast-changing like land crisis that we're in. And in many ways, unless that is being explicitly addressed, I think unless I'm hearing, or unless we are hearing, the kind of role we are hearing, that we are trying to change the position of that and how that's being connected in order to address this problem, I would be unsurprised if there wouldn't be a 17th sometime soon.
Yeah, it's interesting as well that in the run-up to this election, we did cover extensively this campaign by architects, and they were calling for a proper cabinet-level minister for housing, reframing the whole department. The role really, as it is now, sort of fits within the existing framework, which is of a sort of developer-led solution to the housing crisis, basically. Now, we're on the topic of appointments. So Peter Murray, founder of the London Festival of Architecture, co-founder of New London Architecture, recently gave a lecture in which he called on Sadiq Khan to appoint a city architect. Okay, many cities around the world have got a city architect, pretty standard practice in a lot of places. And Peter Murray, he pointed to Richard Rogers, the famous architect of many buildings, the Lloyds Building, Pompidou, etc., and said that basically Richard Rogers was a kind of de facto city architect under Ken Livingstone. And he argues that that legacy of Rogers, which was promoting high density standards and quality public space, really ran deep in London through that era. So Akhil, much of your work's London based, you're a Londoner. What do you make of this idea of a city architect? Would it be a good thing for London?
Yeah, you know, I think that, like you said, there's a lot of cities across the world that have city architects. And actually, I'm lucky enough to be familiar with one. So Finn Williams, who's the city architect for Malmö, was my previous boss when I was at public practice and also kind of mentor. We were in Malmö with him some months ago. And he had a really interesting take on this idea of the city architect. I think there are some really amazing things that you can do in terms of the advocacy of that role. I think at the same time, it can be a fragile role, and some of these chief advocacy roles that sit within government, something like the Night Czar, that they do receive some criticism because of the frailty of that type of position. In an interview with Architecture Today, actually, he once said that we don't just need one city architect, but a city of architects.
Interesting.
And I think there's
some... Sounds like a catchphrase.
Yeah, it sounds like a Bojo catchphrase, but I think there is actually a lot in that. I think that there's this idea of... The idea of like electing to the leadership of this role just for the advocacy of like design standards goes against what like a disseminated logic around like how do we start to like in a very kind of de-centered way influence and build the capacity of a fractured system. Like we have a system by which decisions are being made in lots of different ways. Actually, we have cities which have local authorities which are structured and hierarchized in increasingly different ways. Does it make sense to have one person at the top of the pyramid who's doing those things? I think that actually a decentralized approach is really a much sexier way of thinking about this problem. The Richard Rogers example by Peter Murray is a Peter Murray example, you know, yeah. If ever there was one.
Because like, he's from that era.
100%. Yeah. He's, yeah. You know, I mean, that's his guy. Like, that's what he knows. And actually, like, to prop Finn Williams up, I think, like, what he's doing in Malmö is thinking about the capacity, increasing the capacities of his colleagues, of those within, like, all forms of the local government.
If you enjoy The Brief by Open City, please like, follow, or leave us a review. By doing this, it helps others find our show and means we can keep on creating balanced news about architecture and the built environment. Your support is really appreciated. Now, back to the show. Moving on from the excitement of a new government to big architecture world news. On Tuesday last week, the outcome of the Royal Institute of British Architects, that's the RIBA's, presidential race was announced. Chris Williamson, co-founder of the practice Weston Williamson and Partners, was elected, beating academic and environmentalist Duncan Baker-Brown and the RIBA councillor Fumbi Adiagbo. Williamson will start his two-year term in September 2025, succeeding Mace architect Miyiwa Oki. Known as a transport and urban planning expert, Williamson spent 5 years working for Michael Hopkins Architects before forming Weston Williamson Architects in 1985. He was the partner in charge of the Jubilee Line station project at London Bridge between 1991 and 1999. More recently, AJ reported that Weston Williamson and Partners have been involved in Saudi Arabia's mega project, The Line, a linear city that under its original plans would eventually be home to around 9 million people. Williamson was also a RIBA councillor member for 6 years and is a former RIBA international vice president. He told the AJ that his motivation to run for president was because he was seriously concerned that the RIBA won't survive another generation. Voter turnout was shockingly low. Williamson was elected by the Institute's membership with an overall turnout of 9.3%. That's a 3.1% decrease from the previous election. Okay, Akhil, what do you make of this result? Why do you think Chris Williamson was elected?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why Chris Williamson was elected. I think that the voter turnout is indicative of something. And I know that in the last one, the Future Architect Front was kind of deeply involved in Mui's election and actually like advocating for that role, and it received a lot of attention. At the same time, I wonder, you know, there's this fear of the RIBA dying, and I wonder why we're so fearful of this whole dinosaur thing kind of like falling to the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Chris Williamson's a very well-known person in the industry and certainly like a nice guy. Like, he turns up to events and he's quite generous with his time. So I can kind of imagine why people sort of went with a familiar, yeah, you know, character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like you said, like, you know, voter turnout, it is worryingly low. You know, it's led some architects to question the kind of broader effectiveness of the RIBA, you know, the future of the RIBA, something which Chris himself, you know, put at the centre of his campaign. Why do you think members feel so apparently disenfranchised, disengaged with this institution?
Yeah, I'm not a member, so that's probably the first thing to say, because, you know, I don't practice as an actual architect at the moment, and so we work within architecture, but I'm not part three, part two, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. Despite having some connection to it, so Seth and I are honorary fellows of the RIBA. Rather than focusing resources around addressing those questions, I think we need to center the questions themselves. That question of disenfranchisement. If the RIBA as an institution isn't serving its purpose, which it seems like it demonstrably isn't, what's preventing us from abolishing it? What's preventing us from restructuring the entire thing? That for me is the question worth addressing.
Well, I imagine the people who work there and the councillors and the people there, they might have some opinions on that I can't represent on their behalf.
But I'm sure. Yeah. But then at the same time, like, how much vested interest is there in the RIBA right now? The RIBA isn't even the qualifying body for architecture, right? That's ARB. So it's like, I think there's also a perception of some of our institutions which fills most of the penumbra of this thing. And actually the middle bit, the umbra, it's actual significance and actually how entwined it is in their lives and the professions of other people, it's probably smaller than we think.
So obviously, yeah, the criticism is commonplace, but let's think constructively. Okay, so what's the future of the RIBA? What does it look like when everyone does have buy-in? Can Chris Williamson, you know, can he build that?
Maybe to preface as well, I'm an anti-institutionist in some way, then that doesn't mean that I don't think there's efficacy in institutions, but I do think there's also a way about thinking about system change today, which involves infrastructure rather than institutions. Actually, the role of the institution seems to me like an old school way of conserving and consecrating resource rather than redistributing.
Like a gentleman's club kind
of gentleman's
model.
Club type model, which essentially is what it is. And that's not even my part for the critique. I think that's just an understanding of how these things are formed. For me, what Williamson would have to do, or what anyone in that head would have to do, was to think about how we redistribute some of the resource that works in those places. I think that there are these telling signs about what an institution looks like when you go to different places. We're working on a project in Liverpool at the moment in the RIBA North Building. There's like one or two people there who are working there. It's a leftover. It's a colonial frontier in the north. You know what I mean?
But it's like a contemporary building.
Building is one of the ones that ruined their UNESCO heritage status, et cetera, et cetera. So very funky in that way. But on a logistical way, it's like, it kind of also shows you how London-centric this organisation is. It kind of shows you what the type of model of distribution this organisation is looking like. And I wonder if a different type of association of architects isn't one that's like on the ground, isn't one that's actually like in the local spaces in which these architects are. How do we start not from the centre, but a redistributed network? I sometimes think about Imi Kerr from Civic Square talks about how the NHS was started and those initial pre-war tests in Wales around how they tried these neighbourhood clinics, these roving neighbourhood clinics around how we address public health. What I'm talking about is an old thing too. You know, what I'm talking about is an old thing too. There's a way about thinking about the distributed capacities of a professional body or a demographic and then addressing that in a more kind of distributed way.
Just quickly, some people might hear your critique on infrastructure and say, yeah, that's why we're putting tens of millions of pounds into renewing the RIBA headquarters building, building a whole new infrastructure. What do you say to that?
For me, that's the sign of the institution trying to conserve itself. I think the self-perpetuation of institutions is part of what I think about as the kind of topology of it, like a way of describing an institution without talking about what it is and what it does. An architectural institution, an art institution, a cultural institution, take away those kind of epithets and think about this idea of the institution, the telltale sign, the need to try and refurbish its centre. That money, I know, wouldn't have been enough to go into many, many other centres, but I do wonder what it could have done in terms of how we rethink what the organisation does. The Cultural Institute, or Het Nieuwe Institute in Rotterdam, they went through a period a few years ago of what they called the Klooster period, which is where they closed down all their exhibitions, kept all the workers on pay, and engaged in 2 different years of intensive intra-discussion around where the institution looks like next. What does the institution of the future look like? That way of like using resource to actually just think inwards, to really, really scheme and conspire about what we can do for the future, that I think is a better way of using the money.
And then we mentioned in the intro the line, Saudi Arabia's mega project. It's been mired in controversy, quite severe controversy. It's fascinating that someone involved in this has won this RIBA presidential election. What do you think this says about the profession generally?
You know what? I think from an anthropological view, this is the profession. The line is the profession. I've had so many conversations about this line in which it's popped up. I've been talking to someone who they work in an architecture company about green this or whatever that. And I'd be like, what project are you guys working on? Oh, yeah, we're working on the line. I was like, damn, everyone's working on the line.
You're telling me you're not working on the line?
I said, why aren't we working on the line? Why has no one called Resolve for the social... You know what I mean?
System change
for the line. Genuinely, though, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, the line seems to be all-encompassing. For me, it's like, you know, when you see the visual of the line, not knowing so much about the kind of ins and outs of it, you see, it looks like one of those projects which is bound never to exist.
It exists massively on computers in London.
Right.
And probably won't exist.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe it's more of a kind of Cedric Price funhouse type situation. Maybe it's actually like a deep concept for us all to buy into. A way of like reaffirming our neoliberal tendencies and actually like galvanising us towards the end. And maybe that's what the line actually is, because I really can't get my head around it.
And for our final story of today's show, on Wednesday, the Grenfell Tower Memorial Commission and the RIBA launched the process to select the team that will design the future memorial on the site of Grenfell Tower. It's been 7 years since the devastating fire at Grenfell Tower that left 72 people dead. Survivors, the bereaved and campaigners say there is still no justice, no prosecutions have been brought, and the shell of the building still stands. There have been many spontaneous memorials, flowers, green ribbons, graffiti, silent walks, but with passing time, there is a risk that what happened might be forgotten. In 2019, the Grenfell Tower Memorial Commission was established in order to formalise how the site would be remembered and ensure the community is heard. The Commission's 10 community representatives said, "Launching the Memorial Design Team selection process brings us a significant step closer to turning the Grenfell community's memorial vision into a physical reality. Through this process, we intend to identify and appoint a specialist and worthy design team, a team that has proved experience of working on sensitive and community-focused projects, and who has clearly demonstrated the integrity with which they will approach this vital task." End quote. The final team is expected to be selected and announced in spring 2025. Okay, so Akhil, what is the significance that this memorial project is finally moving forward 7 years on, and why is it so important to so many people?
Yeah, I think it's of significance because of what you said around the unresolved side of the situation. There is still no justice, and a lot of the community believe that. A lot of the organizations that are kind of going for justice around this also believe that. And I think that there is a sense in which, that sense in which we've been let down by the state, that sense in which particularly black and brown bodies in the area are being let down by RBKC, is still fresh. And although there have been a national wane in some of the attention, I feel like there is still that same intensity, there's still that same trauma within those communities. So for that reason, I think that there's a huge, significance to this idea of trying to commemorate, but also of making that entwined with the path for justice.
I mean, the process of working on a memorial commission, I mean, what is that actually like as an architect or designer? You know, what does that look like for also for the commissioners right now, for the community group, you know, coming up with the brief and stuff? Like, what do people go through in thinking?
We've been involved in some kind of, maybe memorial, like statuesque projects, but often with this rethinking angle. And a kind of decolonial angle as well. But I have my personal skepticism sometimes around those processes. Despite myself having been moved by some memorials in my life and etc., I can only imagine that they're the real ambivalence. And I think there's also perhaps a kind of mix of attitudes towards how this is being done. I know that there are lots of community members who want justice and that's it. And without justice, this is a kind of empty, this is an empty promise. I know that there'll be people who are thinking about actually how do we write this into the memory, into the built environment, and to the fabric of the society. And I think that's also supported. There's so many outcomes, there's so many varying opinions to this, despite there being this overarching idea that there is something valuable in commemorating the tragic loss, though we're yet to have justice. It's a really difficult situation. I don't envy anyone who's in that selecting committee.
So there's some details in the brief. It talks about a kind of solemn, thoughtful, respectful place. It talks about a garden, possibly a structure where people can pray or reflect on what's happened. It's in the brief that the government hasn't actually decided what to do with the tower itself. So people participating in this process, which is a sort of community engagement and design process, need to think about designs that work with the tower in place or not in place, for example. So that's quite interesting. The Memorial Commission has opted for this to be an open competition, you know, where anyone can apply. And that's a really interesting route to go down, right? What are the kind of strengths and weaknesses of this route?
Yeah, there's a difficulty in making something an open competition because actually, like, you introduce a competitive element to something which is tragic, and something which is ongoing in people's lives. But I have seen in the past some occasions where that has almost got to a case by which the people who end up delivering the work are really people who wouldn't have otherwise been thought of or invited to do so. In Croydon a few years ago, there was a competition to do the forecourt of an area in Thornton Heath, and a group of squatters who were occupying the tower, they went into the competition. And I think like that's there is some utility in that, right? Actually, this openness by which we, if it's correctly disseminated, we can get to the right types of people who wouldn't have otherwise been invited, for sure. That, I think, could be really interesting.
Yeah, it would be fascinating if that then becomes a wider learning process that reflects back on, you know, the public sector when it comes to social housing delivery, that this memorial is not just a memorial but to the people who died, but also to a better future where things like this don't happen and everybody's treated with respect. Okay, so we're moving on to the culture section where we talk about interesting things that people are watching, reading, listening in the cultural space of architecture and the built environment and in London. So some quick Open City stuff. So just to let everyone know, the Open City shop sale has been extended to Sunday. So that's everything from our Pocket London printed tours, our Model London Build at Home kits, all our acclaimed publications, even some Design Heritage themed socks. That is currently 20% off at the Open City shop. If you pop in the discount code OCJULY24. Also, I just want to let people know that you can volunteer at this year's Open House Festival and get inside some of London's most remarkable buildings. So the Open House Festival will take place between Saturday the 14th and Sunday the 22nd of September. It's an annual celebration of London's architecture and neighbourhoods and the people and communities behind them. It wouldn't be possible to do this festival without the help from hundreds of volunteers every year. Amazing people. We need you to volunteer and help make this year's festival a success. As a festival volunteer, you'd get privileged access to some of the most remarkable buildings in London. It's really fun. You get priority entry to drop-in activities across the festival programme. And from midday on Friday, the 16th of August, registered volunteers will be able to choose from a list of hundreds of different buildings that have requested volunteer support. So all you need to do is go on our website and register for a volunteer account. If you have registered in previous years, you don't need to register again, just to reassure you. So Akhil, what's on your cultural radar? I understand you've just got back from Remarkable Gala, where you've been working with organisations focused on community arts and the built environment. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, I've just come back from Palestine. I was there for the last week and a bit, working with the Katan Foundation, who are based in Ramallah. And that was a kind of convening of different cultural workers and artists in solidarity that was looking at connecting, but also strategizing and trying to kind of cohere and link up these different strategies. It was a week of kind of lots of connections. So we connected to groups all across the West Bank and Hebron, in Nablus, in Bethlehem, but then also in Jerusalem and kind of other parts. So there was a real onus on what these connections were doing, but then also a disjuncture, a kind of difficult disjuncture around what to do within the context of Gaza, because, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners will know, these are territories which are separate. There's not a freedom of movement between the West Bank and Gaza, or the West Bank and for the Palestinians in 48 in Jerusalem. For me, there was a really, really beautiful synergy between different groups who were connected in what their aims were to do, but were disparate in where they were. And our role as outsiders in lots of ways, as a kind of a catalyzing agent for the kind of inherent qualities of some of those groups. There's a really amazing group in and around Ramallah called Rewak, who are a group of kind of architectural conservators. And they work on the kind of living heritage of Palestine, now not just looking at kind of like previous British Mandate and Ottoman buildings, but the regeneration of the peasant architecture of Palestine, so the kind of everyday architecture of Palestine. There's tons of really amazing young groups. Some of them huge, some of them very, very small. Radio Al-Hara, who are a kind of Palestinian liberation organization and radio space. They've just opened a space called the Wonder Cabinet, which is a beautiful and huge building in Bethlehem. And through that, they've hosted a number of different residencies. They have an open studio where they do their 24 hours Radio Al-Hara as well. They commission really, really beautiful work in and around the Crimson Valley, which is the valley that goes near Bethlehem. They've become a kind of integral part of the art infrastructure in that area. The struggle for Palestinian liberation is something which connects many, many different types of struggles, struggles for social justice across the world. How do we work with one another? How do we try to think about our ecology as being something which spreads not just to our areas, but also to areas like Palestine and the West Bank and in Ramallah and Jerusalem and in all these places? And how do we conspire together? What the goal is here is to think beyond solidarity and to think about how we work together as this kind of in this networked struggle.
And so obviously within the sort of confines of the culture section, yeah, which is signposting stuff that people can like get in touch with in their sort of cultural radar, yes, whether it's in London, the UK. So how can they sort of plug into the sort of artifacts and outcomes from this? Yeah. For example, is this going to be through Projects Resolve here? And is there a sort of umbrella of resources that you can direct people towards?
Yes. So that's good. Great to direct me on that one. So Radio Al-Hara in Bethlehem and the Wonder Cabinet have a kind of consistent ongoing program of different events and things that you can tune into. You can also tune into Radio Al-Hara. They play all the time, so you can listen to them online.
And what else on the cultural radar? A show in Liverpool?
And so on the cultural radar here, and I've got my phone here so I've make sure I've got my dates. So we've got a project with Tate Liverpool where we're redistributing a lot of the old stuff from their old building. They've now temporarily relocated to the RBA building in the docks. And so our exhibition is there, which is around the redistribution of materials to different community groups and thinking about how that catalyzes creative community practice. That exhibition ends today. So today is the last day for everyone up in Liverpool. Today being the 10th of July, and I know this isn't going to come out on the 10th of July, so if you see it, you see it. And so over the weekend, we're working with the Liverpool African Caribbean Centre and a series of other different groups to redistribute some of the remaining materials within the exhibition. And that is going to be a real kind of talk-stuff event. We've got free food, we've got sound systems. We're going to have a real kind of real good time redistributing some of these materials. So that's in Liverpool this weekend. On the 27th of July, one of our collaborators and co-conspirators, Evie Muir, who is a practitioner that leads Peaks of Colour, a kind of walking group for people of colour across the peaks, comes out with her inaugural book, Radical Rest, and that's being launched in Sheffield on the 27th. That'd be really amazing. Dig Where You Stand, which is the Dig Where You Stand Biennale in Sheffield, which has been led by the amazing archivist and practitioner, Desiree Reynolds. That launches on Thursday the 18th, and also the next day as well, and goes on until August. That is a super, super brilliant collection of practitioners, individuals across Sheffield that have been like repositioning the role of black people in Sheffield's history. One last plug, and this is another Resolve plug. And so we've been working at Camberwell Space, which is a kind of artist residency space in UAL in Camberwell. And so we've been doing a lot of work around material redistribution, which is kind of the tint of what the Liverpool project is. But here we're looking very explicitly at taking materials from old exhibitions at cultural institutions and depositing them in this space to be taken freely by practitioners, community members, etc. Every Wednesday until November, we're going to be having open days. So today we have an open day where you can pop in and get a look and get a feel and also take materials. It's open throughout the week as well. And so if you follow Material Store 2024 on Instagram, you can find those places. Sorry, can I add one more thing to the plug?
Yes, please.
Sorry, I just saw what it was. I looked at the diary. I was like, So Skin Deep, who are a race and culture organization and magazine, are turning 10 years old this week.
Okay.
And their birthday is on Sunday, the 14th of July. So this coming Sunday, they've got their 10th birthday. There are tickets that are still available. It's going to be an amazing time. Music, food, etc. Come through.
Beautiful. Akhil, it's been an immense pleasure to feature you on the show. Where should listeners go to stay up to speed on your output? Should they go to your website or social media handles? Are you on?
Definitely social media. At Resolve Collective is on Instagram. But the thing that really, really you should be doing is signing up to our newsletter. So if you go on our Instagram, you see one of the posts that is about the newsletter. Sign up, because that's the most in-depth. It keeps everything super up to date.
I'll be doing that right away. Thank you to my guest, Akhil Scaife-Smith. The Brief is brought to you by Open City, an educational charity empowering communities to learn about, experience, and have a role in shaping places where they live. I'm Merlin Fulcher. The Brief was produced by May Robson. See you next week.
You've been listening to The Brief from Open City, made in association with the London Society and the 20th Century Society. This show is made possible in part thanks to Bloomberg Connects, a free digital guide to art and cultural organisations around the world. A link to download Bloomberg Connects is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed The Brief and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which covers all these issues and many more. To get early ad-free access to The Brief and support Open City's wider work, empowering young people from underrepresented communities, please become an Open City friend today. The link is in the show notes. The Brief is produced by Poppy Waring and hosted by Phineas Harper, Merlin Fulcher, Cyber Chadder, and Fran Williams. The series editor is Merlin Fulcher. Our theme music is by Chris Zabriskie. Open City is dedicated to making cities everywhere more open, accessible, and equitable.